I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So again, I'm here to officially welcome everyone to today's internet seminar, the NARPM Presents session on EPA and the NIEHS Superfund Research Program as they collaborate to meet community technical assistance needs at Superfund sites. I'm now going to turn things over to Melissa Dreyfus, who's joining you here at the US EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. And I'll let Melissa kick things off as we pull up her material.
Great. Thank you, Jean. My name is Melissa Dreyfus. I'm an environmental health scientist here at EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, Community Involvement and Program Initiatives Branch, and I'm so happy to be here today with all of our presenters giving this webinar for you, so thank you for joining us. Just as an overview of what we're going to be discussing today, we're going to begin with a background on EPA's Pilot Partners in Technical Assistance Program, or PTAP. We're also going to hear about the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and then have a brief time for discussion and questions. And as Jean mentioned, we're going to be taking questions from the chat pod only for the beginning part of the webinar. And then at the end of the webinar, we will turn to the phone line for questions if we have time. So I encourage you all to put your questions in the chat pod, and we will get to as many of them as we can throughout the presentation. Next, we will turn to Oregon State University Superfund Research Program to hear more about their collaboration with EPA on our first PTAP project at the Black Butte Mine Superfund site. We'll take some quick questions after that project and then continue on to hear from the University of Arizona and University of North Carolina Superfund Research Program centers to hear them discuss the second PTAP bioavailability project and also hear an introduction from my colleague at EPA here on that project as well. And then we'll just have a wrap-up and some opportunity for discussion and questions. So I'd like to begin just by giving you our brief overview of some of the tools and resources that we have here in the EPA Superfund Research Program to enhance community involvement at Superfund sites. We use many different tools and resources, and providing technical assistance helps the community to be better equipped to participate in the cleanup and reuse decision-making process. So we are going to focus today on the pilot PTAP program, which is the blue puzzle piece there. But I thought it would be important to show how several of our tools and resources fit together. As you can see in the middle there is a technical assistance needs assessment, or TANA, which is one way to determine a community's technical assistance needs, and it's a process that helps the site team in determining what those technical assistance needs of a community may be and gives us a record of what some of the unmet technical assistance needs are and enhances opportunities for EPA to partner with other organizations to address those needs and to ensure the most efficient utilization of our various technical assistance resources and tools. And so you can see there's various other tools there, including our Technical Assistance Services for Communities contract, our Technical Assistance Grants, the Conflict Prevention and Resolution Services, another contract mechanism. But of course, many technical assistance needs can be met directly by the EPA site teams working in the regions. And these site teams have the most up-to-date information about the site's cleanup, and the site teams are usually able to provide technical assistance as staff and resources are available. So just to talk a little bit more about our Partners in Technical Assistance Program pilot, the objective of PTAP is to expand opportunities for cooperation between EPA and colleges and universities with the shared goal of assessing and addressing the unmet technical assistance needs of impacted communities. So through this program, colleges and universities would cooperate with EPA and voluntarily commit to assist communities with their unaddressed technical assistance needs. So there's no exchange of funds in this program. It's all on a voluntary basis. This program is best for sites with limited funding or where technical assistance needs are outside of EPA's scope of work. So we're currently piloting this PTAP approach with the NIEHS Superfund Research Program grantees at Superfund sites. And again, we do have some polls going on right now. If you'd like to answer those, we get a better feel for your familiarity with some of our technical assistance resources. So some examples of technical assistance services that could be provided through PTAP include training on environmental issues, perhaps redevelopment planning or neutral facilitation, reading or explaining technical reports, community outreach and involvement, doing some research on scientific or technical issues and reporting and communicating those to communities, or helping to build the capacity of existing community groups. The one item I will mention that is beyond the scope of PTAP is access to our sites to sample for research purposes. That would be handled through other venues of our Superfund program and not through PTAP. So some of the benefits to communities of this collaboration through PTAP are that existing grassroots community organizations can receive capacity building assistance. For example, the communities could benefit from a neutral third party providing technical assistance and expertise. And hopefully some community education needs could also be effectively and efficiently addressed through a collaborative relationship. And this collaborative relationship could also help to minimize the duplication of technical assistance provided to an impacted community. So on this slide, I've described several benefits to our partners who participate in PTAP. And as I mentioned, for this pilot phase, our partners are the NIEHS SRP grantees. So some of these examples are specific to the SRPs, but could also be applicable to any college or university. So it helps the SRP grantee in determining what the technical assistance needs of the community impacted by a given site could be, and also helps them in meeting the requirement of establishing community partnerships for their community engagement core activities. And our next speaker is going to go more into depth about the SRP program, and she'll explain what the community engagement core is. The PTAP partnership also helps to open the lines of communication between the SRP grantees, the impacted communities, and EPA. Helps them to engage communities really at the earliest stage possible in the Superfund process. And importantly, gives their trainees and their students opportunities to collaborate with communities and have some of that real-life experience. It really helps to streamline the process of establishing partnerships between EPA and the grantees, and provides an opportunity for the SRP centers to collaborate amongst themselves as well. And so just to kind of summarize here, the PTAP program really can benefit communities, EPA, and the PTAP partners. It provides an opportunity for communities to have a trusted, non-governmental, independent technical perspective. The PTAP members can assist the community with technical needs that could be beyond those that could be effectively addressed by EPA. And the colleges, universities, and other PTAP partners can bring a new perspective and energy to the process while gaining valuable real-life experiences for their students. And so we currently have 18 of the Superfund Research Program centers who have signed the PTAP Memorandum of Understanding and joined this pilot program as partners, which is really great. And now I'm going to turn to Michelle Heacock, who will give a brief overview of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program. So Dr. Heacock helps coordinate the research translation and community engagement cores for the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, that's NIEHS, Superfund Research Program, and oversees grants within the SRP. She received her PhD in biochemistry and biophysics from Texas A&M University at College Station and completed her postdoctoral training studying the cellular mechanisms of toxicity at the NIEHS. So Michelle, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Melissa. And good afternoon, everyone. And I thank all of you for taking the time to participate in today's webinar. So as Melissa mentioned, my name is Michelle Heacock, and I'm one of the staff members of the Superfund Research Program, and I'm here today to give you a little background on the SRP. So the SRP is part of the NIH, which is part of Health and Human Services, or HHS. The NIH consists of 27 institutes, which includes an institute most people might be familiar with, NCI, National Cancer Institute. The NIHS, the institute that we're housed in, was established in the 1960s, and it's the institute of the NIH whose mission is to discover how the environment affects people in order to promote healthier lives. Before I go any further, can you all hear me okay, Jean? Am I coming through okay?
You are just fine.
Great, thank you. In fact, the NIHS is going to be celebrating its 50th anniversary next year. So the SRP, which is housed at the NIHS, is a university-based basic research program that was created in 1986 under the Superfund Amendments Reauthorization Act, or SARA. Congress under SARA authorized NIHS to develop a university-based program of basic research and training grants to address the wide array of scientific uncertainties facing the National Superfund program. So the SRP was designed to complement existing activities related to hazardous substances and human health and the environment within the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, so EPA, who's the principal manager of the Superfund program, and the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, or ATSDR, which is part of CDC, the Centers for Disease Control. So next slide. So the scientific parameters under which the Superfund research program operates were included in the SARA legislation, which mandates that research funded by this program should include development of methods and technology to detect hazardous substances in the environment, advanced techniques for the detection, assessment, and evaluation of the effect on the human health of hazardous substances, and methods to assess the risk to human health presented by hazardous substances. And finally, basic biological, chemical, and physical methods to reduce the amount and toxicity of hazardous substances or remediation techniques. So to meet these mandates, the SRP offers multiple grant mechanisms, so ways to receive funding to address each of these mandates. The P42 Multi-Project Center Grant is one of these mechanisms. The Individual Research Project, or RR1, is another one. The Small Business Grants that foster commercialization of technologies, also known as SBIRs, STTRs. The R25, which supports occupational environmental health training and emerging issues, as well as supplement awards that provide opportunities for trainees to cross-train. And we also provide technology transfer opportunities for our grantees. And it's important to note that each grant must meet one of the four mandates that I just told you about. So I just want to give you a little bit of information about the P42s. These are our big center grants. So since 1987, the SRP has funded the P42 mechanism for coordinated multi-project multidisciplinary research. So these interdisciplinary centers, say that 10 times fast, link and integrate biomedical research with related environmental science research within the context of unique scientific themes developed by the applicant. So every center has a theme that they're working around. The biomedical projects, which I'm showing here as the purple pie slice, address the human health-related implications of hazardous substances that can include research projects that are mechanistic-based toxicology studies, epidemiology, human risk assessment, genetic susceptibility, and even computational toxicology. The environmental science and engineering projects, which I'm showing as the green pie slice, addresses questions concerning hazardous substances drawing from engineering, geology, ecology, microbiology, fate and transport, hydrogeology, remediation, and detection sciences. So the P42 program components are really meant to cover the broad mandates, those four mandates I mentioned, through interacting projects and cores with a variety of health and environmental disciplines, as well as training. And what we're going to hear a lot about today is community engagement and research translation. All tie this together and integrate to address a problem or set of problems encountered by exposure to hazardous substances. So I'll provide a little bit more detail for the research translation and community engagement cores after giving you an idea of where SRP research is being conducted across the country. And if you're interested in learning more about these P42 centers, I've got a link at the bottom of one of these slides. If not, maybe I'll send them to Jean and she can provide them in the materials. So here's just a map of SRP across the country. And so each of these dots represent, give you an idea of where SRP research is being conducted. So there's a legend just to the right that shows you the location of our P42 centers, which is the focus of this talk, because the P42 centers are what house the research translation and community engagement cores. And they're denoted by the purple stars on the map. And most of, as Melissa mentioned, most of these P42 centers are voluntary PTAP partners. And today, you'll be hearing from our OSU, Arizona, and UNC P42 centers on a pilot and an in-progress PTAP activity. I should also point out that while we're not a Superfund site-specific program, we don't require our grantees to be working on a Superfund site, they do conduct research on sites to test their technology or to work and engage with the community. And as Melissa said, the PTAP program isn't meant to access sites, so I'll just be sure to point that out. And the locations of these sites where our SRP researchers are working are denoted as these blue dots on the map. So next, now I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the research translation and community engagement cores. So as I mentioned, the presentations you'll hear today are the result of our research translation and community engagement cores working together. And I'll give you a description of how each of these cores, of what comprises each of these cores, and how they work together to disseminate SRP research to stakeholders so that it's understood and meaningful. So each of our P42 research translation cores have four objectives. So communicating within the Superfund research program, partnering with government agencies, technology transfer, and information dissemination to other end users, all with the purpose to communicate and facilitate use of research findings coming from the program. So today's presentations are a great example of how government researcher community partnership was and is being used to disseminate and communicate technical information and expertise in a way or ways so that can be understood by a community who's in need. So the light blue text at the bottom that I've got here will directly point you towards a description of each of the research translation cores and who are the contact information for each of the core leaders. So the next slide, I'll tell you just a little bit about our community engagement core. So they serve the program by supporting or guiding communities, community advocates, or community organizations. So they draw from the science of the program. And the key to this core is that it makes bi-directional connections with communities impacted by hazardous waste sites or other hazardous substances. This bi-directional communication is part of why the research dissemination can be meaningful, because each of the center aims to listen and hear a community stakeholder's concern that it can be incorporated into their research activities. So some examples of community engagement activities that occur within our program include partnering with tribes to determine exposure pathways relevant to their traditional cultural practices, assisting a community in accessing pertinent information, providing scientific expertise in response to a community's questions, conducting coursework and community-based service projects. So those last three are really things we're going to hear about in the presentations that follow. So it's important to note that, for simplicity's sake, that, you know, although we've shown the research translation, community engagement core, and for that matter, the rest of these pie slices, sort of as separate, distinct, almost siloed slices, we really want to emphasize that each of these groups work together, work closely with the research project leaders as well as each other, so the expertise is complemented and they draw upon each other. So today you'll hear about such complementation in the PTAP projects that will follow. And finally, I just wanted, and so again at the bottom, there's a URL that you can click on, and that'll give you a listing of all the community engagement cores that we have and the contact information for each of the leaders of those cores. And so finally is just a slide that includes some contact information. So I mentioned that I'm one of the SRP staff members. Dr. Sook is the director of the SRP, and he has been since inception in 1987, so he's really molded it to be what it is today. Dr. Carlin, Daniel Carlin, myself, and Dr. Heather Henry are program administrators who oversee the grants I told you about today. And last but not least, certainly, is Alicia Lawson, who's has a master's in public health, and she's our health specialist in our group, and she works with me to help coordinate the research translation and community engagement cores. So with that, I thank you for taking the time to listen, and I will pass it to the next speaker.
Great. Thank you, Michelle. That was a lot of interesting information about the Superfund research program at NIEHS, and I do see from our polls that about 73% of you were aware of the SRP program, but only about 30% of you have collaborated with an SRP center. So maybe this webinar is an opportunity to learn more and make those connections. So now we'll turn our focus to the first of two case studies from our pilot PTAP program. The first project involved the Black Butte Mine Superfund site in a collaboration with Oregon State University Superfund Research Program. The team also worked extensively with Elena Conley, the EPA Community Involvement Coordinator at the site, and Richard Musa, the EPA Remedial Project Manager on the site for this project. And Elena and Rich were unable to join us today, so I'll just start by giving a brief background of the site before focusing on the PTAP project. So you'll see a map here of the site location in Oregon. The Black Butte Mine Superfund site is located near Cottage Grove, Oregon, in Lane County, EPA Region 10. Mercury and other contamination from tailing piles at the abandoned mine site affects creeks that flow into Cottage Grove Reservoir and the Coast Fork Willamette River. The Black Butte Mine operated between the 1890s and late 1960s, and it was one of the largest mercury mines in Oregon. The Black Butte Mine site was added to EPA's National Priorities List on March 4, 2010, and the listing makes the site eligible to receive federal funds for long-term cleanup. So in July of 2012, there was a community information session that EPA held with residents of Lane County and Cottage Grove to learn more about how we can best inform and keep residents updated on our site activities. One of the suggestions came in from Lori Briggs, who is the former principal, now retired, at the London School in Cottage Grove, and she suggested that materials to educate students about the mine, about mercury and health in the environment, would be really helpful. And that we could educate the community by educating the children. So as I briefly touched on before about a TANA, we did conduct a TANA at the Black Butte Mine Superfund site in Cottage Grove under our Technical Assistance Services for Communities contract in March of 2013 to learn a little bit more about what some of the needs of the communities was. And based on that, TANA and the results, we issued a PTAP request for response in June 2013, which was basically the request for assistance from our PTAP partners to help at this site. Oregon State University Superfund Research Program began a partnership with EPA through this pilot program to specifically expand upon the community outreach capabilities surrounding the Black Butte site. And in December 2013, OSU and EPA met with Lori Briggs, the principal of the school, because she really wanted to give her students and their families science and environmental health knowledge. Her school is made up of about 100 rural kindergarten through eighth grade students. And we had monthly meetings for this PTAP project that continued through September of 2014. And so I'm now going to turn it over to Naomi Hirsch and Diana Rollman from OSU to talk more about the specifics of the Black Butte Mine project. Naomi Hirsch is the Research Translation Coordinator for the Superfund Research Program at Oregon State University. In this role, she focuses on communicating and promoting center research in ways that build relationships and meet the needs of stakeholders. She's been an NIEHS grantee since 2003 and has worked on a variety of educational projects on environmental health topics for both K-12 students and community audiences. In recent years, her niche has been on finding effective ways to communicate science online and social media training for scientists. Diana Rollman is the Outreach and Engagement Coordinator for the Superfund Research Program and the Environmental Health Sciences Center at Oregon State University. Within the Superfund Research Program, she works with Pacific Northwest tribal communities to better understand unique exposure pathways and to identify culturally appropriate risk reduction strategies. She has worked at Oregon State since 2013 and has been involved in K-12 and community environmental health programs in Washington, Oregon, and Ohio to include community-based participatory research. So I will now turn it over to Naomi and Diana to tell us more about this project.
Hello, thank you so much for that. This is Diana. I believe Naomi is going to be running the slides for us. Naomi, are you on? All right, I'm hoping she is on. Can anyone hear me? Oh,
yes,
wonderful.
Yes, we can. And this is Jean, and I'll click as needed.
Thank you. All right. So I wanted to sort of go through an overview of how we started this project. So you had a wonderful overview of what the PTAP project was. So after that assessment was done, the Community Engagement Corps and the Research Translation Corps at Oregon State had the opportunity to travel down to London School. That's us at the school, and we met with Lori Briggs. And Lori had some fantastic ideas. That's actually Lori standing next to Naomi, so second from the right. She asked for us to create a hands-on project-based curricula or educational package that could address the community and the community needs as well as the needs of her students. So the school is located near the Black Butte Mine, and while the community is aware of the mercury contamination, there wasn't much more in-depth knowledge that was there. So we came up with the idea of this educational package that we called Mercury, the Community, and Me. It was modules that were designed for grades kindergarten through eighth. So London School is a very small rural school, and the grades are actually combined. So we kept that in mind as we developed this package. We also felt it was very important to create a package that could be easily adapted and modified by the teachers so they can adapt the activities to the needs of their classroom. We also recognize that with this sort of modular outline, which Naomi will be showing in a few slides, this allows for informal and formal education. So teachers can use one activity, they can use a block of activities. These can also be adapted for after school groups. So to start with, we really sort of pulled from our expertise in the Environmental Health Sciences Center, which has an existing plethora of activities on environmental health. So we wanted to start there and then use examples that drew on students' previous experience, so letting students scaffold from what they already know and expand into this new scientific field. With that background in environmental health, you can then apply that to the specific environmental contaminant, in which case here is mercury. As we were designing this package, we also wanted to build in mechanisms that not only educates the students and the community, but also create sort of a mechanism for our Superfund program to have a partnership with this community. And so with that, we talked about ways to integrate some citizen science projects with the students, as well as have a school science fair. And we actually will have a quick update on the school science fair in a few slides. One of the benefits of this was that we were able to provide training opportunities for SRP trainees. The videos that we're going to talk about in a few slides were actually produced by one of our trainees who is very interested in doing outreach and engagement. And we've been able to find other opportunities for our SRP trainees to meet with this community and interact with them and learn about their concerns. The final bullet point was something that came straight from Lori Briggs as we were designing this educational package. The main thrust of it, she felt, was important that we teach about mercury, we teach about how it can move through the environment, and how it can impact human health. But she also felt it was very important that her students be introduced to different careers in environmental and life sciences. And that was the impetus for the first video we created, which is called Careers in Environmental Sciences. And we took that viewpoint as well and imbued that into our second video, the Black Butte Mine, where we were able to highlight different careers within the EPA, within Superfund, and within environmental health and research, how students can move into all of these different scientific disciplines. So with that, I think we can move on to our next slide. this is just an overview of the approach we took. So as I said earlier, we tried to create a modular package of educational materials and videos that would let teachers be able to select and adapt the activities for their classroom. London School is very unique. About 70% of their students qualify for free or reduced lunch. 24% of the students are in the special education program. As it was mentioned, Lori Briggs has retired as principal, but she loves the school so much, she has continued part-time as a special education teacher at this school, so she is still involved in this project. It's also important to note that London School houses many of the community events. So not just a school, this is also a focal point for the community. And there's been several generations of students that have gone through this school where the parents attended and now their children attend. So in order to start building this, we actually pulled from a lot of different resources. And I think if we can go to the next slide. Wonderful. We pulled from a lot of existing resources. Here you can see the three sections of the package. As I said earlier, we started on section one with environmental health, just laying down a basic understanding of how can our environment impact our health and vice versa. With that background, we can move into section two, which is looking specifically at mercury in the environment and understanding where is mercury, where does it come from, and that's where we introduce the Black Butte mine. And then finally, moving into section three, looking specifically at mercury and human health. To build this, we first began by searching for resources from a wide variety of different agencies and universities. You can see we actually collected resources from over 13 agencies, which included other Superfund research programs, as well as environmental health sciences centers. We were lucky enough to get a fantastic resource from the University of Washington. It's the Quicksilver web module. You should check it out if you get a chance. It's wonderful. We also used the University of Wisconsin Mercury in Schools package and several activities from the Acadia Learning for Participatory Science. But one of the biggest contributors, not surprisingly, was EPA, which has some fantastic online and downloadable materials for students to use. One of the ones that we found was great for kids, especially as the EPA Fish Kids, where you're actually fishing for different fish and looking at the mercury levels. And so with that, I believe I'm going to hand this over to Naomi, who can walk you through how, once this package was built, how we disseminated it.
Can everybody hear me?
We can.
Okay, great. Okay, so we're going to open up, and I'm going to share my desktop to go online.
Okay, Naomi, I've just changed the screen. You should be able to share, and I'll confirm once it's been pulled up. For the individual participants who are watching Naomi, she's actually going to pull up their website and provide us a real-time tour. If you have any problems viewing her content, there is a button which appears in the upper right corner of the window that Naomi is using to show her own screen. You'll see a button that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. Individual participants can feel free to click that four-arrowed button to make her window bigger, if that might make it easier to read her website as she walks through. Naomi, you're up on the screen. Feel free to begin.
Great. Thank you. I want to take you to our Superfund program website, to the portal page of this project. It's located at superfund.oregonstate.edu/mercury. The page is a portal to the organized educational activities, which is the teacher resource page, the background information, and the videos that Diana shared that we produced. I wanted you to know that for these videos that we produced, the Careers in Environmental Health and the Black Butte Mine, we provide teacher guide and student worksheets. We also include other relevant videos from other groups. Mercury in the San Francisco Bay from QED is excellent, and we developed a worksheet and teacher key to go with that. Mercury in Your Health from the National Library of Medicine, and Mercury from Source to Seafood from our colleagues at Dartmouth Superfund program. So now we're going to link to this teacher resource page. The educational packet to download is in PDF format, and it's 50 pages long. I'm going to open that up. All of the it includes all of the educational activities organized by sections and modules and by grades K through 3rd and 4th through 8th, just like Diana explained. They're big age ranges, but we're really just suggesting activities and providing a sample activity plan and keeping everything very adaptable for educators. So an example for the first section on environmental health for K through 3, we give an overview, suggested duration, learning objectives, materials, a suggested activity schedule, and then extension and resources. And then we lay out the lesson plan very, very clearly for the teachers and provide background resources to help prepare and empower them to share and teach about these topics. The activities we share are diverse. Some can be used with individual students on a computer. We provided these knowing that London School has an excellent computer room. Some have worksheets, some incorporate art and stories, and some involve students working in teams. The key was we didn't want to call this project the Black Butte Mine. This came from Lori Briggs also. We wanted a general name, so this packet can be used anywhere in the United States where there's an issue with mercury. So we're going to go back to our main site. Scroll down. We make it easy to find and view all the activities that we suggest in the packet. Just like the packet, it's organized by section and module. You can quickly view and download a specific activity or worksheet, see the topics it includes, and get related resources. So you can see there's a lot of activities. I'm going to scroll down. And then I'm going to scroll quickly back, and we're going to go back to our main portal page. On the Learn More link, it goes back to take you what you've learned about today, the background of this project and how it got started. And you can actually hear Principal Lori Briggs, former Principal Lori Briggs, talk about why she wanted to do the project. We have a recording. So we're
going to
go do this.
Okay, Naomi, I've pulled up the slides. We should be leaving off where we were just at, slide number 22. And you should be able to click back over on your end to pull the slides back up.
And I don't see it on my end.
If you look in the bottom portion of your screen, you should see the Adobe Connect environment. Looks like that little gray box.
Yeah, I clicked on it. I just don't see the screens anymore. I mean, I don't see my PowerPoint slide.
Okay. Well, you may want to rejoin the webinar. In the interim, I can certainly pull up the videos if you can refer to the presentation materials, and we can play them back.
Great. That would be great. Diana will introduce the video clips, and you can show the videos, and I will re-enter the webinar.
Okay. Wonderful. Diana, whenever you're ready.
We're on slide 23, Naomi, just so you know, with the videos. We're hoping to show you just some snippets of the videos. We're going to start with the Careers in Environmental Health video. Again, this was a request directly from London School to introduce students to various careers in science. What we wanted to focus on is that environmental health is such a broad discipline, and it covers so many different fields. So we just gave an example of chemists, biologists, toxicologists, epidemiologists. There's so many different careers that all fall under this topic of environmental health. So working with an MPH student, his name is Corey Fisher, he began working with the Community Engagement Corps and then sort of ended up being shared between the Community Engagement Corps and the Research Translation Corps as he worked on this project. We came up with the idea of interviewing scientists from Oregon State University as well as the Environmental Protection Agency. And we wanted to ask them, what do they do? But we also wanted to ask questions about how did they end up becoming a scientist? And so, you know, we'll ask questions about what were your favorite classes growing up. And we got some really wonderful, honest answers. You know, one person said their favorite class was the history of rock and roll. It was a literature class. But the idea was to show the very different pathways people took to become a scientist and why their job is so important to them. Now, Jean, did you want to go ahead and show that snippet of the video, and then I can introduce the next one afterwards?
Absolutely. So I'm going to pull up the videos. Just a reminder, these videos will play back in the Adobe Connect environment. The audio will take place through your computer speakers. So if you are a presenter, make sure your telephones are muted and you guys re-enable your speakers. You can hear. For those participants, you'll need to adjust your computer audio so that you can hear the videos appropriately. If you are on the phone line, see if you can get your computer speakers to turn on. Otherwise, I've shared links that you can use to play back after today's broadcast.
Hi, my name is Kira Lynch.
Laura Beaver.
Renee Brooks.
My name is Diana Rollman.
Perry Heistad.
My name is Mark Johnson.
Yasmin Nkrumah Ellie.
Anna Harding.
Paul Meyer.
Hi, my name is Lane Tidwell.
My name is Molly Kyle, and I'm an environmental epidemiologist.
Isotope ecology, but I'm also a plant physiologist and an isotope hydrologist.
Professor of public health.
I'm a research ecologist.
Program coordinator for the Superfund Research Program, as well as the Environmental Health Sciences Center.
I'm a research soil scientist.
I study chemicals in our environment.
I am a toxicologist.
Oh, my day-to-day life is fun. Part of my job involves going to the field, which includes places like Bangladesh, to measure chemical exposures from drinking water out there. Part of my job is as a college instructor and lecturer. So I teach students about environmental epidemiology. I get to work in the lab, and then I also do a lot of writing.
My job entails three main tasks. Going out into the environment and collecting samples, which is a lot of fun because I get to go to really neat places like the Gulf of Mexico or Ohio or Africa or Peru and bring back samples to the laboratory. The next portion of my job is taking those samples and analyzing them on really expensive, really complex instruments and doing some fun chemistry. And then after that, I get to sit down at my computer and take all the data that I get from the instrument and enter it into models that help us understand how these compounds move throughout the environment and how we interact with them as humans.
My day-to-day, every day is completely different. So yesterday I taught 93rd graders. 2 weeks ago I was in Ohio with a research team.
I supervise a group of 18 scientists, all of whom do research of various kinds, and I serve as their supervisor and mentor and help them plan their research.
What I really do is I work with data and I tell stories that I find within this information, pulling together things, trying to understand what the data is telling us.
I think my work makes a difference because environmental
Okay, so I believe we're going to now switch back and take a look at the next video, correct?
Yes, we are. So we're going to switch gears a little bit now and look at a video that we created specifically for education on the Black Butte Mine. This was also created by Corey Fisher, who I think just did a phenomenal job. The original goal of the video was for the students to learn more about the history of their community and of the Black Butte Mine within their local history. It is a fascinating history. We also had the chance, we were invited to their historical society in Cottage Grove, and there's actually footage from that meeting. Some of the residents have this wealth of knowledge about the history of the Black Butte Mine through their family, and were kind enough to share that information with us, as well as some photographs, and all of that was used to create this video. So I think we're going to watch a short snippet of that as well.
It was one of the highest producing mercury mines on the West Coast. and probably the whole world.
It's still one of the largest deposits of cinnabar in the world inside the mountain. There's over 15 miles of tunnels in the mountain itself.
Cinnabar is a crystallized form of sulfur and mercury. The cinnabar is crushed and burned, and the sulfur gas allowed to escape. This leaves behind the mercury, which can be collected and sold. The large deposits of low-grade cinnabar were responsible for the high mercury production of the mine.
It's a reddish, dull red kind of a color, and then we still find it down by the mill. It's kind of rotted now, but you still find chunks of it that was getting ready to go into the crusher. The mercury was heated and then it ran through these big condensing tubes that were probably two stories tall. There were six of them. And at the end of them, there was a tube that came out and it filled these big, heavy rubber buckets.
The mining equipment from the Dennis furnace still remains at the Black Butte mine, 45 years after the mine closed in 1969.
There's a big ore hopper up there that's huge. I mean, the timbers on it are 20 by 20 fir, and the boards that go around it, they're 6 by 18s. And in the last couple of months, it's probably tilted 5 foot.
Dozens of structures, homes once inhabited by mine workers, old mining equipment, and the two mercury furnaces can still be found at the mine site, often surrounded by mine tailings. Mine tailings are the rock and ore left behind once the mercury has been removed. These tailings, which still contain some mercury, were used to create roads that crisscross the mountain. These roads still exist today. The Black Butte mine was closed in 1969 after having been the fourth largest producer of mercury in Oregon. Waste rock, mill waste, and the tailings remain on site as a byproduct of processing the ore. In 2010, the Black Butte mine was included on the National Priorities List for cleanup because mercury and heavy metal contamination from the site has migrated into waterways.
EPA listed it on what we call the National Priorities List, which is a Superfund list, back in 2010. And we're beginning with our consultant CDM Smith to investigate what the impacts of this historic mining operation have been to the environment and what impacts are currently still occurring to the environment.
Okay, well, we've concluded that portion of the video. We're going to switch back to the slides. Naomi, are you still with us on the line?
Yes. Can you hear me?
We can. Okay,
great.
So I'll just leave it to you both to carry on.
The next slide. And I can't seem to move the next slide forward. Oh, thank you. So in conclusion, the key to this project was the partnerships. The PTAP project enhanced the relationships between EPA Region 10 and our SRP Center, and we now have contacts for future projects. Like Diana and I shared, we leveraged existing resources and produced products that were co-created by the London community, like the Black Butte Mine video, and co-created with our EPA Region 10 partners, like the Careers in Environmental Health video. We leveraged the EPA greatly in the promotion of the project, especially the videos. It was shared on many EPA social media accounts region-wide, on Twitter, Facebook, and blogs. Because of that, many people were able to learn not just about this project, but about our entire program and our research. And by far, it was our most visited pages on our website this past year. We want to continue to share about it so the resources and products get used, and we really appreciate the opportunity to share on this webinar. And another important benefit that has been talked about throughout this webinar is the training opportunity for graduate students. We always want to give our center trainees real-life outreach opportunities. And like Diana said, a graduate student led the production of the two videos. And more recently, a graduate student came with Diana and I to London School to judge science posters at the Earth Day Family Science Night.
which happened, I guess, a couple weeks ago, which that was a great experience. And we continue to build a relationship with London School. And I think it was mentioned by Diana, the school is planning to debut the Mercury materials this coming school year, and we will be providing assistance to them. Let's see if I can get the next. So why I have you all here, I wanted to give a quick overview of our program at Oregon State University. Our center has a unique partnership with the Pacific Northwest National Lab in Richland, Washington. And although the project focus, was on mercury, our center focus is on polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbon mixtures, or PAHs. And PAHs raise concern at over 800 Superfund sites. And as many of you know, many individual PAHs have been identified as potential causes of cancer, impeding normal development, and targeting the neurological and reproductive systems. So I wanted to mention we just produced a 7.5-minute video that provides an overview of PAHs and why they are important to study. And the video is available off of our website, and I hope you'll view it, and you can share with me ways we can enhance it for your specific audience and needs. And I'm planning to create an educator guide and student worksheet for that video, just like we did for this Mercury project. And that video, the PAH video is a video at first in a series that we'll be producing in the future. And as you can see from this slide, we have three biomedical projects in blue and two non-biomedical or environmental science projects in green, and then six research support cores in orange. And like Michelle said earlier, the projects and cores all work together to help bring answers, solutions, and to further understanding to our communities and stakeholders. And our training core provides the valuable training opportunities to grad students. So I just invite you to visit our website. And finally, I wanted to acknowledge people who are involved in this project. It was a team effort between the Research Translation Corps and Community Engagement Corps. And our Community Engagement Corps focuses on tribes in the Northwest. Besides Diana and myself, Dr. Molly Kyle and Corey Fisher from the Community Engagement Corps both contributed greatly to this project. And Corey is the grad student who produced the videos. And with that, I just wanted to open up to questions. Unless, Diana, you want to add anything?
No, I think that covers just about everything. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. Thank you both, Naomi and Diana, for that excellent overview of our first PTAP pilot project at the Black Butte Mine site. We did have one question come in that's asking for a little more detail about how we structured our collaboration, how often we met, and then, you know, who was involved in reviewing the materials. I'll just say from the EPA side, I and my management was involved from the headquarters level, but it was largely an effort at the regional level with Elena Connolly and Rich Musa and Kira Lynch, and then several of our other regional staff who you'll see in the Career in Sciences video. And then Naomi had mentioned several members of her team as well. We did meet on at least a monthly basis, and that included the Oregon State team and our EPA team, and often Lori Briggs from the London School. And I'll let Naomi and Diana talk a little bit more about, you know, the structure of how often we met in the review process, if they'd like to add anything.
Sure. This is Diana. So on our end, in terms of compiling the package, I would say in the first probably month, myself, Naomi, and I believe Dave Stone, we all started sort of collating resources. Naomi had set up a share drive for us to begin collating those resources. From then on, I started pulling together everything into a framework. We would discuss the framework at our monthly meetings in terms of beginning with the environmental health overview and then moving into mercury in the environment and then ending on mercury and human health. Once I had pulled together the package with the different sections that we just walked you through, each person in the core, in both community core and in the research translation core and some of the, our EPA partners, was assigned a section to go through and review and comment on the applicability of the resources as well as other resources that could be added. So we ended up having about a full month to 2 months of where this was reviewed and went through final edits. And at all stages, this was shared with Lori Briggs at London School, who was able to talk about if this was meeting her intended needs. Naomi, if you wanted to add to that.
No, I think that's good. We just took really good notes and tried to make sure our roles were clear. When you're working on mostly the phone with a group of people from different places, there are challenges, but we got through it. I don't have much to add.
Great, thank you. Yeah, and I will say I thought it was a really great collaborative relationship, certainly a ton of work done on the part of Oregon State. And, you know, we had our site team in Region 10. It really was really supportive of all the information that was produced by Oregon State, and we all had a chance to review that information throughout the process and, of course, before the final products were released. So we all really appreciate all the work that Oregon State did on this project. So moving on at this point, we would like to turn to our second PTAP pilot project on communicating bioavailability of lead and arsenic in soil. And just a note for this project, the materials are very much still in the development phase and will need to undergo regional and management review here at EPA before they're finalized, but we wanted to offer a preview of a non-site specific PTAP project that also involves a collaboration between two of our SRP grantees. So we'll first hear some background on this project from Dr. Michelle Burgess. Michelle is a senior biologist with EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, the Science Policy Branch, and has over 18 years of experience as a human health risk assessor with state, regional, and headquarters experience. She is also a tri-chair of the Technical Review Work Group for Lead and Bioavailability. So I will turn it over to Michelle.
Okay, great, thank you. And thank you for being here today. So, as Melissa said, I'm the tri-chair of a technical review work group, and this is a collaboration between the one particular work group which just deals with bioavailability. And again, just to highlight the fact that this is primarily focused on human health. We're noticing in the communities that there's three different ways of expressing bioavailability, one with human health, and that's what you see here on this slide about what bioavailability means to our work group and the definition, but then there's also ecological as well as plant uptake bioavailability. So quickly we started to realize that not only was it difficult to translate or define it within our own community and how we use it, it was across other communities. And when I say that, I mean in communities of scientists. So if we couldn't even understand what each other was talking about, how would we deal with this in a public venue where we're using this kind of term to select cleanup levels for our site. So as you can see, what the project purpose was just to assist us with developing materials to help the public understand the concept of bioavailability and then how we would use that in our risk assessments and then towards our remedial goals. Just a little bit about the TRW. Like I said, this particular project is a collaborative project between the Technical Review Work Group for Bioavailability, which is comprised of regional folks as well as our Office in Research and Development. And a special shout out goes to Sophia Cerda of Region 9 because she's been very helpful in helping provide materials that she has, and also her close ties with her communities where she has used this concept to select remedial goals and to do the risk assessments. Our initial focus was strictly on lead and arsenic in soil and how much of those chemicals are bioavailable if you incidentally ingest them or in child incidentally ingested them. We've now been asked by regional support to help look at PAHs as well as dioxin bioavailability. So now we have two subgroups that are focused on if someone wants to perform a test like that at your site, how would you perform that test and what would that mean for your risk assessment? Now, this is just a strict overview of what our mission is, and our primary thing is site support and developing documents to help the regions and states understand and use bioavailability in their risk assessments, in particular from soil. And again, most specifically oral ingestion, although we have had questions about the dermal absorption from contacted soil. We've looked at new methods for assessing bioavailability, and right now we have an assay. It's just like a leach-type assay that correlates really well to animal studies that we're about to put out on the street to use, and it's relatively cheap, and it gives you a better sense of, instead of thinking it's 100% bioavailable, it's showing that it's not necessarily at your site, depending on what kind of lead you have in the soil. We also do a lot of work in trying to pull together the application and availability of different kinds of relative bioavailable sources. We're right now actually putting a poll out to the regions to see if there's other metals or other compounds that we should be focusing on as we move into the next fiscal year. These next few slides are just an overview. I just really wanted this to be a reference point for you all. This is a pretty productive group, and they're very excited about the kind of work they do. And we do have a website that has all of this information housed. But these are just a few examples of things that we have been particularly proud of, and that is the guidance for evaluating bioavailability of metals and soils, the validation of the lead assay that I was just telling you about, as well as the SOP, standard operating procedures for our lab practitioners. This last one here is kind of been interesting, and that is we've tried to look at, is there a way that we can amend soils or treat soils and make lead not bioaccessible? So we did a lit search to just look at the state of the science, and that's why our ORD partners are really important to us, because they're going to help us with trying to understand that and whether or not there is a way to treat soils instead of just dig and haul, which we normally would do in many situations, or cover it. But could we actually do something that would be sustainable over the long term? This is just another one. This is, again, review articles on different arsenic and other other things that we've just been working on, as well as the dioxin framework that we put together. These are some new major developments that we're working on that we're not quite done with, and that is we're all now looking at a leach test, if you will, this in vitro test for arsenic in soil, and we're starting to look at new research agendas that looks at trying to look at bioavailability and dioxins and pHs. So as you can imagine, as we keep producing these documents and we're trying to promote this out at our site, it's going to become even more important to us to learn how to communicate that to the public. And that's where I'm really grateful for our colleagues at Arizona and UNC in helping us with this effort. With that, I'll move on. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Michelle, for that overview. And as you can hear, here at headquarters and in the regions, we've done a lot of work for a technical audience on this topic, and this collaboration here is really a nice example of where we're looking for some expertise at communicating the concept of bioavailability of arsenic and lead in soil at Superfund sites to a more public audience for communities. And so now I'm going to turn it over to our presenters from the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill Superfund Research Program to give you more detail on our second PTAP project. So first we'll hear from Dr. Sarah Wilkinson at the University of Arizona. Sarah is the Research Translation Coordinator for the Superfund Research Program at UA. She is responsible for communicating the research activities of the SRP with pertinent audiences, including government agencies, other research institutions, and the community. Dr. Wilkinson received her undergraduate degree in biology from the University of Arizona and received her PhD in postdoctoral training in cancer biology at the University of Arizona. In her current position, she enjoys building upon her biomedical research background to learn more about the environmental health and science communication areas. We'll then hear from Kathleen Gray and Dana Hain at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Kathleen Gray directs the outreach and research translation efforts of UNC's SRP Center in the Gilling School of Global Public Health and is the Associate Director for Outreach and Public Service in the UNC Institute for the Environment, managing the Environmental Research Resource Program. Ms. Gray has over 20 years of experience conducting environmental health education with community audiences and assisting businesses and government agencies in making sustainable choices. Kathleen earned an MSPH in Environmental Sciences and Engineering from UNC Chapel Hill and a BS in Mathematics from Vanderbilt University. Dana Hain is the content lead on this PTAP project for the UNC SRP and is a science educator in her ninth year with the UNC Superfund Research Program. Dana brings to this collaboration over 20 years of life science education experience, which has included developing educational materials on hazardous contamination with an emphasis on cell molecular biology and environmental health concepts for adult learners. Ms. Hain earned her MS in biology from Wake Forest University and her BS in biology from Appalachian State University. And so I am going to turn it over to Sarah to begin our presentation with a little overview of the University of Arizona Superfund Research Program.
Thanks, Melissa. Am I coming through?
Yes, you are.
Great. So I'm just going to give a few slides to introduce our program and how we relate to the PTAP. At the UA SRP, we study hazardous waste, risk, and remediation of mining waste in the U.S. Southwest, and our goals are to use toxicologic and geochemical studies to support the development of a risk assessment process for dust, water, and associated metal contaminants that are generated by hard rock mining, and to develop innovative remediation technologies that will mitigate this risk. And our research are very, our results are very relevant to the third of the world, which is arid or semi-arid, in which mining is often prevalent. Also, the contaminants that we study, such as arsenic and small size particulates, are ubiquitous throughout the world, regardless of climatic conditions. Here is a conceptual model that captures the essence of how our biomedical and environmental projects come together around the issues of mining. Our four biomedical projects, sorry, let me get my little arrow, which you see up here, are centered around defining exposures and health impacts of metal toxicants and mining waste with a focus on arsenic and its effects on early development and cancer. Because we focus on arid environments, our studies also consider both inhalation and ingestion routes of exposure. Then our four environmental projects, which wrap around down to here, are focused on characterizing the surface and subsurface fate and transport of metals associated with mining waste, both before and after remediation, including the assessment of bioaccessibility. Then we have four support cores, which support and expand on the project through research translation, community engagement, and training the next generation of transdisciplinary scientists. Together, our research translation and community engagement goals of empowering community members with evidence-based information, our experience in developing informational materials for a variety of stakeholders, and our research expertise in arsenic, lead, and bioavailability felt like a very good fit for this particular PTAP call and for the overall PTAP goal of connecting community and federal stakeholder needs. And here's just another example of how we have tied together our projects and cores at a single Superfund site, the Iron King Mine and Humboldt Smelter, where we've been active since before the site was listed in 2008. We have projects ranging from our Garden Roots project that worked with citizen scientists to determine the level of metals in homegrown vegetables, to our phytostabilization project, which looks at how plants can effectively stabilize contaminants in the mine tailings. We have two dust towers at the mine tailings sites, which are assessing whether windborne dust coming off the tailings are carrying metals, and to assess the effects of the phytostabilization field trial in limiting that dust and the contaminants. Our mesh study is assessing how community exposures are how the community is being exposed relative to the mine tailings, and then our bioaccessibility study is looking at how much arsenic and lead and other metals from the mining waste is potentially available in body fluid using a system that models conditions in the body. Again, our research translation and community engagement cores support this work, and we've also developed an effective working group with our regional EPA and ATSDR offices and state environmental and health agencies. The bioavailability of arsenic and lead in the soil is an important issue at this site, something that the EPA is working on, something the ATSDR is interested in, and for other stakeholders. And we're hoping to improve not only our scientific understanding of this issue, but also to develop tools that our group and our agency partners will be able to use with community members impacted by this site and other sites. So we've been really grateful to for the opportunity to do so through this PTAP project. And maybe we'll add another arrow along here one day that adds our additional partners with the UNC SRP and the new EPA partners that we've been forming through this opportunity. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to my colleagues at the UNC SRP, I think starting with Kathleen Gray.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah. So I'm just going to give a quick intro to the UNC Superfund Research Program, and then I'll turn it over to Dana, who Michelle introduced as really our content expert on this project. So our Superfund Research Program is organized a little differently than Arizona's. You can see our mission statement here on this slide. As opposed to being focused on a specific process and type of region, we are really rooted in risk assessment and the risk assessment process, and we have a group of projects that really look at what's going on inside the body, some of the mechanics of how contaminants are processed in our bodies, and then also the implication of those findings for field remediation. So we're really looking at human and environmental health risks and how we can better understand those risks inside the body, and then how we can remediate in the field. And testing our skills to move ahead here. Sorry. So anyway, these are a quick summary of our five research projects, just so you can get a sense for the breadth of the kind of work we do. The biomedical projects are focused on a number of different contaminants, including PCBs, formaldehyde, TCE, and a suite of metals. And when we are looking at those different compounds, we're looking at oxidative stress and what's happening in the body that triggers oxidative stress or other inflammation responses in the body. How does the body break down TCE? And then Rebecca Fry's work is, she's looking at a whole variety, actually, of metals processing in the body, but particularly has some projects looking at prenatal exposure and how mother's exposure affects babies. So that's our biomedical projects. And then in our environmental science projects, we're looking at PAHs and bioremediation in contaminated soil, and also looking at the degradation byproducts of bioremediation and finding some interesting findings there about enhanced toxicity. And we also have a project where we're deploying passive sampling devices in both water and sediment and understanding how contaminants change over time. Now I'm going to touch on, we have the same organization as the others, as both Arizona and then as Michelle introduced up front, all of the SRPs in terms of research projects and cores, but rather than going through the mechanics of that for you, I'm going to just talk about some projects that positioned us to join this PTAP project, why we thought it made sense for us and why we believe we have things to contribute. So we have two projects that, one, we're part of a national network and the other one has national relevance, I think. They're both related to fish consumption, so certainly bioavailability becomes an issue when you're talking about consumption of contaminated fish. The one project that is national and convened by EPA is FishNet, and so some of you on the call, I believe, are participants in that network. But basically, EPA has convened this national working group of researchers, EPA folks. I don't know, Melissa will have to say whether there are any state agency folks who participate, but a variety of people who are either researching or working in community settings on fish consumption advisories and how we understand the science and also better communicate those advisories in communities. And then we here in North Carolina have been doing research over the past year in terms of how at a Superfund site in central North Carolina with PCB contamination, there's a PCB advisory and there's also a mercury advisory. So we've been researching how communities understand those advisories, whether they're aware of them, if they're aware of them, how they understand them, and do they understand both advisories, that, you know, sort of the detail of what it means to have more than one advisory in place. And that research, we've been tapping into other Superfund centers and other EPA offices to inform that work, so that certainly has national relevance. And then, skip ahead, yeah, thanks. The last projects I want to mention are really more regional North Carolina-specific projects, but we partnered over the last 3 to 4 years with our state health department, North Carolina DHHS, to help them conduct some public health assessments that were happening around Superfund sites. And so there were two sites in eastern North Carolina where we helped conduct the community interviews that were required by the ATSDR process. And we learned of some exposures through those interviews. We learned of some exposures that hadn't been previously documented right around and on the sites based on unknown community uses of the sites. So we certainly began to really delve a little bit more into exposure in the field and bioavailability issues on that project. And then a longer standing project is looking at contaminants in private wells. And on that project, we also partnered with our DHHS. They've been collecting data for over 12 years, some of it on paper, some of it electronic, of contamination in private wells across North Carolina, and we took that data and digitized it and then converted it into maps so we could better see data patterns of concern across the state, and we identified a previously unidentified cluster of counties that had high arsenic levels and really connected with our existing Superfund research on arsenic exposure in this project about well water, but it also began to get us into bioavailability issues with metals. So that positioned us to say, when EPA put out this call for a bioavailability project focused on metals, oh, we think we have something to bring to the table, and we're very interested in partnering with Arizona and just generally developing materials that help people understand contamination. So I'm going to turn over to Dana so she can get into the specifics of what we're developing together.
And this is Melissa. Just before Dana talks about this particular project, we are about to have several polls pop up during this section of the webinar, just keeping you all on your toes, and we'd love to hear more about your thoughts on some of these issues as we work to develop this material. So please do answer these poll questions as we continue with our next few slides. Thank you.
Thanks. I think Sarah Wilkinson is actually going to go through the next few slides with us.
Yes. Sorry, we might have had a little mix-up with that in the planning of the PowerPoint notes. But thank you. This is Sarah Wilkinson again with the U of A, and I'm just going to touch on a little bit the original project task and how we got to where we are now. As you've heard a little bit about, the EPA had identified a need for tools that could help the public understand how incorporating data on the relative bioavailability of metals in soils into their risk assessments at Superfund sites might influence site cleanup levels or remedy decisions. So our original task was to work with the EPA to develop materials for the public explaining the concept of relative bioavailability. That is, how much of the arsenic and lead are absorbed into the body from the soil relative to how much is absorbed from food or water. Unlike the previous project, which we heard from the OSU group, this one isn't centered around a specific Superfund site and a specific community, but this could be used more broadly in communities than any applicable Superfund site. And as we were outlining a narrative for the topic and researching what materials were already available, we found that information on the basic concept of bioavailability itself was a bit hard to come by, and we thought it would be best to step back and start with the basics, because we weren't really finding enough just in plain language. As Michelle talked about, there's lots of technical information out there, but we wanted to step back and define bioavailability, or the amount of the contaminant that's absorbed into the body following skin contact, ingestion, or inhalation. And then we could move into relative bioavailability, comparing how much of it is absorbed from the soil relative to the other routes of ingestion. And as we were developing this, the interrelated concepts of bioaccessibility also came up, and we struggled with how to simplify these various concepts and their somewhat complex relationship. In addition, some of the distinctions between the different types of studies and the different data endpoints are related to whether they're modeled in vitro or in vivo, using a variety of different animal models. And concerns were raised that issues of animal testing might open up a whole new can of worms with community members and ultimately distract from the message about bioavailability. As we continue to dialogue with our EPA partners throughout the process and to consider our target audience and what their needs for this information might be, we decided to limit the concepts and materials to simply bioavailability, and you'll hear more about that shortly. And as has been mentioned, this is still a work in progress, and throughout our presentation, we are open to hearing your thoughts on the concepts and the visuals that we've developed so far, and we welcome your feedback via the polls that you can see in the chat box, in the Q&A session, or offline after the presentation. So ultimately, we honed our messaging down to the following main points, supported by a more extensive dialogue narrative containing additional details. The take-home messages that we've come down to are, first, that not all of the contaminants present in soil are present in a form that can impact health. Two, once someone is exposed, only the bioavailable forms of arsenic and lead will be absorbed into the body, that is, taken up into the bloodstream where it has the potential to exert a biological response. Three, knowing the bioavailability of arsenic and lead can better inform EPA and other regulatory decisions at the site, including whether and how much cleanup needs to be done, in order to still protect human health at the same level. This can also have implications for the chosen remedy, the time it might take, the cost of cleanup. And four, whatever the bioavailability of a contaminant is, there are common sense steps that each person can take to limit exposure to dust and soils. simple things like taking your shoes off at the door, washing your hands after playing outside, especially for children, damp dusting versus dry dusting, practicing safe gardening, things like that. And we're hoping that by providing practical tools that will help community members feel empowered to protect themselves and their families, it'll give them a positive take-home message from these materials. And as we have developed a more complete narrative and then honed our main messages, we've been working in parallel to develop the educational materials, which will ultimately be the final product. We're working to develop effective visuals and infographics that can be used consistently across the various materials to best express the main concepts of bioavailability to community members. UNC has graciously offered to hire a graphic designer to help with this, and Dana will be taking you through some of the draft visuals in a few minutes. Again, we're open to your feedback in this and welcome any comments. So to date, our draft materials include a double-sided fact sheet and a PowerPoint presentation. Additional materials will also include a video, as UNC has experience with developing a video, and they also have some funds to put into it. As we all know, videos can be very expensive. And we're also looking to develop an instructional guide for a hands-on demonstration. Here at the U of A, we have some experience in developing and pilot testing hands-on activities related to mining in tribal community college classrooms, and we've had a lot of success working with our enthusiastic graduate students, much like Naomi mentioned in their project, to develop these kinds of materials and activities in the past. So I'm anticipating that we'll have a good time developing something for this PTAP. We're envisioning that materials can be accessed by the general public via the EPA website, but also they're going to be handed out at community meetings by EPA and other agencies at impacted sites. And as you'll hear a little more about, we'll expect that the materials and the examples can be tailored by the practitioners to fit the specifics of each unique Superfund site and each unique community's needs. The narrative that we've developed has mostly just been part of the process of getting the details right and ensuring that we have consistent take-home messages. But we feel that it could also be a helpful tool for RPMs and CICs to have in their back pocket, to have a better handle on clear and consistent bioavailability concepts and basic details. And in particular, we'd love to hear from you whether that's something that you think you could use. And with that, I'll hand it over to my colleague, Dana Hain, at the UNC SRP, and she'll tell you a little bit more about some of the concepts and visuals that we've developed so far.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. Like Sarah mentioned, we're in the process of developing a fact sheet and a PowerPoint slide set for use with target audiences. And so one thing that we have been wanting to do is develop graphics to kind of convey these concepts visually. And these are just my renditions of graphics, but our intent would be that these would be used by a graphic designer to inform better graphics that could have a more consistent look and then be inserted into fact sheets, PowerPoints, et cetera, the video potentially as well. So one thing we want to convey to people is that contaminated soil could contain, or oftentimes does contain different forms of a contaminant. So that's what's trying to be illustrated here, is this kind of zoomed in, a piece of sediment here with different forms of arsenic present, shown in the light and dark circles. So what we want to kind of illustrate here is that the total concentration of a metal in soil is oftentimes greater than the bioavailable concentration. One thing I do want to say is because these graphics are being developed, we're open to feedback for how to, you know, we want to make sure they're scientifically accurate and that they're going to work with audiences. So we do hope to kind of pilot these materials with an impacted community once they're ready. So in the last slide, we kind of introduced the idea that there can be different forms of arsenic or lead in contaminated soil. Some of these forms bioavailable, others not bioavailable. So trying now to relate that to what that means for the human body. So showing here, of course, what the route of exposure we're mostly concerned with here in this work is oral ingestion of contaminated soil. So if this soil were ingested, the bioavailable arsenic would be taken into the stomach, absorbed into the bloodstream, and that's kind of, we're trying to illustrate this here with the three light-colored circles in the upper part of the body. And then the non-bioavailable arsenic or lead would not be absorbed into the bloodstream, would just make its way through the digestive system to ultimately be excreted. So as bioavailability decreases in a soil sample, then presumably there's less available to elicit a biological response in the body. The other thing we wanted to do was to, you know, show people why this information is useful, and it's useful for a couple of different reasons. One, it can inform cleanup and potentially lower cleanup costs, but also by having a better understanding of bioavailability, it can help people understand what their true risk is, so give a more accurate risk assessment. So I like tables for helping people to see and compare information, so we are trying out this approach to put this information in a table. This is just an example. All the data here is it's kind of example data. I did pull it from a Barber Orchard study. But let's just say you have the total concentration of a contaminant at 300 parts per million. If we assume 100% is bioavailable, then that would lead to, in this case, for Barber Orchard, which is in North Carolina, the state-specific target originally was 40 parts per million. The bioavailability studies did reveal that there was less bioavailability than 100%, as is often the case, especially for arsenic. But using numbers that hopefully people could relate to, 50% and 25% bioavailable, which are numbers that were consistent with what they found at Barber Orchard, if a site, you know, if there's 50% bioavailable arsenic, that means the target concentration for soil cleanup can be adjusted. So essentially, as bioavailability decreases, the target soil concentration increases, and that essentially means you could potentially be less stringent in your cleanup strategies, and potentially that could be more cost effective. What we want to convey to people, however, is that their health risk is not changed by taking into account these bioavailability statistics. So here, what we're trying to convey is that as bioavailability decreases, so if you have 25% bioavailability and you clean up the site to, say, 160 parts per million, is the excess lifetime cancer risk is the same as if you were assuming 100% bioavailability. So we're trying to show that factoring bioavailability into risk assessment and cleanup is still going to be protective of human health. What this also showed us, though, is that we are probably going to have to educate people about what this estimated excess lifetime cancer risk means so they can better understand that and evaluate that themselves. So our final slide here, I just extracted this and adapted this definition from the US EPA. And we're working on materials to kind of help further develop this concept, but I just put it in here in part because, and it looks like many of you are answering the poll, we want to know if this is something that you have, that people who work with targeted communities, you know, is this a concept that you have to explain to audiences, and it looks like many of you do, so we would definitely welcome feedback and input on if you have found effective means of communicating this risk, or what you need to communicate it better, because we're certainly at a position to be able to incorporate that into our educational materials. But we really do want to emphasize to audience members that factoring bioavailability into cleanup doesn't kind of weaken the cleanup process, and it's still protective of human health. And I think I've said everything. I don't know if Sarah Wilkinson wants to add anything that I've forgotten. But that's an overview.
I think it's all covered.
Good. Yeah, so our next steps here are to kind of take some of the feedback from this call in terms of the polling questions and any other feedback that comes through, and we're going to start finalizing the fact sheet and the PowerPoint slide set and then get on track to develop graphics and start a video. So we've really enjoyed working with University of Arizona and folks at the EPA, and we look forward to interacting or having the technical work group review our materials as well and learning from that, and hopefully having some site pilot our educational materials in the future. So thank you.
Great. Thank you to Michelle and Sarah and Dana and Kathleen for giving us all a great overview of the PTAP bioavailability project and a preview of some of the possible materials related to that project. With this PTAP project, One project complete and one still ongoing. We do have some lessons learned that we hope to apply to future projects. The first being that it's important to conduct thorough research on our topic at hand before we really dive into the project that we're looking at. You know, Naomi mentioned they have resources from over 13 different areas. They collected materials from different universities and from EPA as well. And I know we did put out a similar call at the beginning of this project for EPA regions. Michelle mentioned Region 9 has some great resources on bioavailability, as well as other universities that we wanted to really do a search of existing information and resources to ensure that we're working with all the currently available information before we really begin a new project. We have also learned that the scoping meeting is important, a meeting that we have between EPA, our EPA regional offices involved in the project, and then our PTAP partners to set expectations and plan the project parameters at the beginning of the project, just so everyone has a common ground for the amount of time and resources and direction that the project is taking. We also learned that these PTAP projects are a great opportunity for trainees. You heard that both from Oregon State and from UNC and U of A, that it's a nice opportunity to have their students interact with the community and learn more about the sites and the topics at hand. And we've seen through this second PTAP project that colleges and universities have the ability to collaborate with each other. And the projects really benefit by having that shared resources and expertise. And so at this point, we really hope this webinar is helpful in demonstrating just two examples of successful collaborations between EPA headquarters, EPA regions, and colleges and universities and communities through the pilot PTAP program. And I will just mention, if you're interested in learning more about community involvement efforts, the EPA Community Involvement Training Conference will be held on August 4th through 6th in Atlanta. And we'll be giving a similar presentation there, as well as many other presentations focusing on efforts to involve communities. And there's a link to that conference, more information and upcoming registration in our related resources document section of the webinar. And so I'm just going to turn to the chat pod and see if we have any questions there. And then we may have a couple minutes to open the phone lines. I did have one question come in. If materials are handed out by EPA at community meetings, does that lose the benefit of quote-unquote independent technical assistance at a site? I'm not sure I completely understand losing the benefit of independent technical assistance, but I will say, you know, these materials are just one possible tool that can be used to help explain the concept of bioavailability to a community that's experiencing that issue at a site near them. We expect that, you know, the site team will also be, you know, providing specific information about the site and tailoring those materials to suit their needs. And we certainly, as I discussed at the beginning of the webinar, have other technical assistance resources that can help communities, and that does not mean that we couldn't, you know, reach out to colleges and universities to help a community related to an issue they're experiencing specific to their site. So I don't think the communities lose the benefit of independent technical assistance by using these materials. I think there's definitely always still a wealth of technical assistance resources that could be available to communities near sites. Let me just scroll through here. Another question is, how do you get a PTAP project at a site? Who has to request it? Does it have to be a federal site, or can you do it at state sites? So I'll just answer kind of the last question first. Right now, PTAP is still in the pilot phase, and we are focusing on communities near Superfund sites specifically. We may in the future consider expanding that pilot to work with other sites. Certainly if you have something in mind, people can feel free to contact me. My email should be on that registration page for the webinar, you know, when you first logged in, and please don't hesitate to call me or email me about site-specific instances where you're interested in a PTAP collaboration. I am the point person for the PTAP pilot project, so I am the person to get in touch with. We are interested in, you know, anyone can present an idea for a project. The model that we are working with currently is that our EPA site teams would approach me with them, that they know a community has some technical assistance needs that could potentially be met through a college or university, a PTAP partner. But we also encourage our PTAP partners, if they know of needs that could be met, to approach me with ideas. And certainly if a community person has an idea as well, we are open to that. So hopefully that answers that question. And Jean, I guess at this point, I don't have any other immediate questions in the chat box, but if we want to open the phone lines and just see if there's any questions there before we close out.
Certainly. So just a gentle reminder for those of you who might be participating via the telephone lines, you can come off of mute by pressing #6. I'd encourage you to either share your location or office, and then feel free to share your comments or questions with Melissa and our other presenters. Remember, it's #6 on your telephone to come off of mute, and then you can feel free to share your question or comment. Okay. Well, I don't hear anybody else on the telephone lines coming off. Melissa, have you seen anything else come into the online question queue while we're waiting?
I did just get one question. How does PTAP differ from TASC? Well, that's a very good question. The first big difference is that PTAP does not involve any exchange of funds. So through PTAP, our partners provide these services and expertise voluntarily. TASC is our Technical Assistance Services for Communities contract, which is a contract run here out of Superfund headquarters that can provide technical assistance to communities through a variety of different ways, but it is through a contract controlled at headquarters. And we do have a website about our TASC program that I can provide in the chat pod for people who'd like to learn more about that. Someone just asked what PTAP stands for. It's the Partners in Technical Assistance Program, and we are in a pilot phase right now. And one other person just asked, how do I get access to Fishnet? I am also the contact person for Fishnet, so please go ahead and send me an email, and I also have your name through the chat box so I can contact you directly. The person who asked the question, I can contact you and add you to that list. Great question. We're always happy. Okay. Well, I really just wanted to give a big thank you to our presenters today. It wouldn't be possible without all of you, and also to all of you who attended, thank you for joining us, and I hope this information was helpful and you've learned more about the NIEHS Superfund Research Program and the grantees of that program and how important these collaborations are between EPA headquarters and our regions and colleges and universities and how that can benefit communities and help to meet some technical assistance needs. So thank you all for joining. And I will post my email right now in the chat box so that you all have it. Thank you very much for joining, and have a good day.
As well as contacting our presenters and organizers from today's session. Again, we want to thank everyone who was able to join us. We did have nearly 100 individuals who were able to sign in and participate in today's webinar. If you are interested in learning about future deliveries, you can certainly visit the CLUIN or Cleanup Information Network website or connect or follow us on any of the popular social and professional networking sites that you see listed on the slide. We do have the presentation materials currently posted on the links or resources page. You can download a PDF copy of the items that were presented today. There are also a whole collection of URLs that are available on that site and will remain up from this point forward. If you happen to be watching or replaying the archived version of today's webinar, you'll find these URLs as well as links to the slides available on the middle right of your screen under the related URLs window. To open up any one of those links, simply click on the link of interest and press the Browse To button.
As mentioned, contact information for our presenters and organizers can be found on the seminar homepage. That's listed under the related URLs pod. And Melissa was kind enough to list her contact information as well in our Q&A window, which should now appear in the lower right of your screen. I would ask if you could take just a brief moment and fill out our short online feedback form to let us know what you thought about today's delivery. We really do appreciate your feedback, and honestly, it's comments from our participants that help us to continue to ensure that webinars like this are offered for free through Clueint. If you shared the line with multiple people, please note each individual person can fill out their own feedback form if they like. That feedback form is active from this point forward, so if you are replaying the archived version, you can still fill out that form and share feedback based off the recorded version of today's webinar. As noted, the session was recorded and will automatically be archived on the Clueint website. You should receive an email as soon as that archive is available, and you can feel free to share that or pass it on to others that you think will find this to be a valuable expenditure of their time. With that, this will be the formal conclusion of today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.